Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Brian Lehrer Show is not live today, so we won't be taking any calls. But we thought we'd take this opportunity to bring you some of our favorite recent segments. So enjoy, and remember that our comments page is always open. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org, live from the Jerome L. Green Performance Space here on Varick Street, with our very enthusiastic, but it really is like Woe Begone because you're very shy, audience that only had a few questions for Paul Krugman. Those more astute listeners out there in radio land may have noticed that last week on Wednesday we did not have New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger on our program, as we had each Wednesday before throughout the month of April. Paul's been joining us for the Cityscapes series, done in collaboration with the WNYC Culture Department. We spent the first few segments looking back at the massive change that New York's skyline and cityscape overall have undergone over the last 10 or 20 years of massive building. But we want to end this series by looking forward and asking what's next. So we delayed last Wednesday's discussion because we thought there's no better place to discuss architecture and no better place to ask what's next than in the place that's next for WNYC, this brand new performance space. So here we are, and we're going to be able to take advantage of some of the audiovisual equipment in the green space as well. Listeners, if you are near a computer, you can participate in this too. You can go to our site where we've posted a slideshow of some images that we'll be discussing during this segment, just like we did earlier last month. Or better yet, you can just stream the video of this conversation, and you'll be able to see not only the slides, but also what Paul Goldberger actually looks like in person, something you've been dying to know, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
It's all at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And, of course, if you're not near a computer, never fear. Paul and I are very good at describing pictures, and we'll find out if Liz Diller is as well. So New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
And we are also joined by the fourth and final participant in the Cityscape series, architect Liz Diller of the firm Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro. And perhaps no person is better equipped to answer the question, what's next, than Liz, who has been described as the first post-wall architect. She is the designer of the recently reopened Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center, in case you wonder who did that. We have some fans. And her renovation of the High Line will open later this summer. And just last week, she was named to Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Wow. So we will ask her exactly what it means to be post-wall, or whether that's just something someone wrote in a profile or as they gave up using Facebook. Liz, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
And again, everyone, if you're near a computer, you can go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show to see the slideshow, and watch streaming video of this whole event if you want. And we'll start this Cityscapes episode, as we have all the others, and that's by playing a bit of video that the architects have done for WNYC. So let's take a look at a clip here in which you, Liz, describe your philosophy behind Alice Tully Hall on site.
Lincoln Center was originally built very defensively and for car culture. The very first act here was taking that away, bringing all the circulation down to the street and actually reintegrating these buildings and this campus with the city.
Car culture? Lincoln Center was built for people driving in? Is that what you meant to say there?
Yeah, in fact, there is a service station in the basement of Lincoln Center in the garage. The original master planners really conceived Lincoln Center for suburban culture coming in, and New York culture, very, you know, a lot of that urban renewal was to demolish a piece of Manhattan and replace it with this Acropolitan place for the arts.
So now we're in the 21st century, and your redesign of Tully is to, I think you put it there, open it up to the street?
Yes. Lincoln Center is built on a plinth, something that people don't really think about.
What's a plinth?
Plinth. It's like a base. The base isn't, in classical terms, doesn't really mean anything symbolically here. It detaches from the abject street, which is unfortunate, mm-hmm. so there's very little communication. But in that base is basically the mechanical engineering plant and the garage. So it's part of 60s planning. It's not very good planning. It's a mega block where all of the streets are cut off, pedestrian circulation is cut off, and the general circulation was brought to plaza level. What we did was we basically brought the circulation back down to the street, and we removed the walls of the plinth. We revealed anything that was worth seeing, and we, if it wasn't worth seeing, we put program in it. And the intention was to make a really nice interface between Lincoln Center, what it does, what it produces, and the street. And that energy going back and forth is really important. So we want to bring culture to the public, turn Lincoln Center inside out, and bring New York vitality right into Lincoln Center, which is sometimes desolate.
So to follow along on the slideshow, those of you who are doing so at home, we saw Lincoln Center, I should say Alice Tully Hall, which is at the north end of Lincoln Center, before and now. So this is before.
That's very definitely before.
That's the old Tully, looking very, Paul looking very Edward Durell Stone-ish with a lot of
very aloof
marble.
Well, it's really about aloofness from the city.
Concrete.
I think that's the key point that Liz is trying to make. In a way, like the original World Trade Center on a platform taken away from the city. You know, in those days, people didn't understand that the greatest thing about New York of all is the streets, the life of the streets.
So the entrance is low, the concrete of the building mm-hmm. is really mostly what's on display. And now we go to slide number two, Tully after. And this, Liz, I guess, is what you were describing just a moment ago. And for those of you who haven't been there yet, it's a lot of glass, for one thing, right?
It's a lot of glass. It's a lot of light into the lobby. The lobby is a public space. It's got a bar cafe. It's also got an external plaza, which is contiguous. The surface itself is contiguous with the internal lobby with a very, very sheer glass line. So we worked very, very hard on the particular design of that glass wall to make it as transparent and accessible as possible.
And so, Paul, is New York a good city for architecture that opens to the street? I mean, so much of New York's architecture seems designed to remind you, you can't come in here, or to be intimidating. Is the future going to be more inviting?
I think we're getting away from that, Brian. I think we figured out that, in fact, ultimately that doesn't work, that the greatest thing about New York is the life of the streets. And, in fact, in this room is a great example of it. I mean, I think 25 years ago, nobody would have wanted to design a studio open to the street like this. Today, it's a natural thing. We love being connected to the life of the city and feeling that it's flowing through everything. So absolutely, in fact, the problem today, I think, is not in projects like Tully Hall, which is great, but in so many others, is almost too much glass right now, not enough.
Now, we have some more slides to look at. Again, as in past weeks, most of these were submitted by listeners who've been engaged in the Cityscape series on this show and produced by our culture department right on WNYC.org. There's so much more than we've done on the air in the Cityscape series. So if you're interested in this kind of thing, definitely check it out at WNYC.org. So we are going past Alice Tully Hall now to what? This is really a picture of cranes, isn't it?
Cranes, new apartment, new condo towers. Unfortunately, those developers didn't time things very well because they're still under construction after the market has gone downhill. If they'd been a year or two ahead, they might have done better. But nonetheless, these buildings are being finished, and they'll open relatively soon. They're seen in juxtaposition with the Empire State Building, which I think is a reminder that we once had the most beautiful skyline in the world, and I'm not sure these buildings particularly contribute that much to it.
However, it's cranes just lingering, waiting to spring into action. These are some pretty tall buildings, but they're not completed. And I guess when the economy comes back, they're going to go right back to it, or is there going to be a big shift? Liz, let me ask you, in what kinds of construction will take place?
Well, I think that they'll probably go right back to building these things. The positive side of this very negative moment is that maybe people will back up. and think about the culture of architecture and what's being built, especially a lot of speculative buildings that are being built. We spent enormous energy on the High Line, for example, and the entire argument for the High Line and the way that we were able to save it was to argue that it was a catalyst for development of that area of Meatpacking District in Chelsea.
And remind people what the High Line actually is and is going to be.
Okay, the High Line is an overhead railway that has been defunct for since 1980, and it's in the Chelsea district of Manhattan. It goes from Gansevoort up to the
an old freight line.
Yeah, right, to the rail yards.
North-south along the far west side.
Exactly, and it's lifted. It's 30 feet up in the air, and it was slated for demolition. One of the last acts of Giuliani was to sign a demolition order. It was saved by the Bloomberg administration, and we've had actually a really, really great administration for architecture. And there was an understanding that this was a site that was really fertile, that could be reimagined as a public park, a kind of promenade in the air. We won a competition to do that park. Now, that entire area was fairly depressed. There was light industry that was kind of vacant, a lot of car lots, very low. The zoning had changed there, and there were ideas about development. Now, the High Line was part of that big idea to develop that area, and just as Central Park was imagined as a catalyst for growth in that part of Manhattan, so was the High Line. But no one would have anticipated the amount of growth. So when we started off being...
it's not even finished and open yet, and it's already stimulated growth. It's already had the effect that was anticipated even before it was ready.
And in fact, those sites had flipped over several times already without even any plans on them.
Right.
So, when we started off being architects of the High Line, we realized we became the guys who are protecting the High Line from architecture. It was a big paradigm shift for us.
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC, live from our Jerome L. Green performance space on the ground floor of 160 Varick Street. There's one person walking by with an umbrella looking in. Hi out there. We're going to have a lot more people looking in through the glass when the weather turns better. This is the final installment of our Cityscape series right now. If you're near a computer, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, because we're looking at some slides that listeners sent in of architecture and other cityscapes around the New York area, and we're talking about it with Paul Goldberger, the New Yorker architecture critic, and architect Liz Diller. By the way, that phrase that we saw used to describe you, the first post-wall architect, what does that mean?
This is the first I've heard of it.
Really?
But I suppose we break down walls. We break down walls between disciplines, where artists, performance artists, architects as well, but we also, as in Lincoln Center, as demonstrated there, one of the biggest creative acts was the removal of walls, the removal of shadows that were produced by overhead plazas and so forth. And so sometimes removing things creatively, editing the city is a good thing.
And I just found out that it was the TED conference that billed you as the first post-wall architect. Right. That's not your blurb,
I'm a great fan of Liz and her work, but I'm not sure I would quite say that. I think probably if anything, you could probably call Frank Lloyd Wright the first post-wall architect, actually.
Let's go to another slide sent in by one of our listeners. This is called Painted Buildings, submitted by Okendo. And one of the considerations when talking about what's next is, of course, figuring out how it fits into what's already here. And the future cityscape will interact with the existing cityscape and the past one. So these are some very colorful walls,
actually.
We have a building here with a lot partly yellow stones, I guess, painted yellow, some orange, some different shades of brown, and what looks like sort of a bluish high glass high-rise right behind it.
This is the Westin Hotel by architect Tanaka at Times Square. It's actually a building I remember quite well because I wrote a piece about it in The New Yorker a few years ago that the editors gave a headline to, "Is this the ugliest building in New York?" Actually, the architects never forgave me for that. I can. So but it's not one of our distinguished buildings.
You haven't warmed to it?
Well, you get used to anything over time, I suppose. But warm to it, no, that's a little strong.
Liz, how about you? I mean, you know, you go to San Francisco, you see very colorful architecture, and it's seen as livening up the city.
There's a lot to think about when it comes to building in cities, and color, material, scale, fenestration, whether you align with the street edge, whether the building takes a shape, whether how it fits within the zoning envelope, and so forth. You know, I'm really all for pushing the envelope and I have a very broad idea of what context means and building responsibly in the context. And it doesn't mean within cornice lines. It doesn't mean building, in brick or a certain proportion of masonry to glass. None of that. It really means kind of getting the feel of where you are and working inside of that. It means kind of understanding the DNA and stretching it and pulling it and taking it the next step. It also means, you know, thinking hard about what buildings should stay, how buildings can stay alive, how not to, you know, freeze them in formaldehyde or something. So how do you bring life to a city? I don't like this building, but not because it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't fit in a kind of in all different ways. It doesn't. It doesn't capture, you know, the right site of Times Square. It doesn't really.
I think it's a very glib and superficial attempt to do the things you're talking about.
Right. It's not just that it's colorful.
No, color's fine. Color's great. I mean, I don't want a monochrome city either.
Speaking of monochrome, let's go to our next slide. This hardly looks like a monochrome. This looks like something out of a horror movie with the reflection. But what it really is our example of glass. This is one of those towers that seem to be everywhere right now. What makes this slide, for those of you who can see it, kind of eerie is the reflection, I guess, and the way the reflection actually catches something. So it's a beautiful, effective photo that our listener John Baumgartner took and posted to our Flickr page. But we see the interaction of old, I guess, the old style building being reflected in the glass. But we've spent a lot of the Cityscapes project, Paul, talking about glass, its aesthetics, its price, its environmental impact. But we haven't really talked about the fact that all these glass buildings do reflect the city around them. So is that a saving grace?
They do, although, Brian, of course, if everything becomes glass, then we won't have pictures like this anymore. Then we'll just have, you know, Andy Warhol once said, if a mirror looks at a mirror, what does it see? So we're going to need to still hold on to some other things. I mean, I think glass is potentially an incredibly beautiful material. Also, transparency is important, as Liz was saying, in certain public places. But it works best as a jewel playing off against other things. I mean, the Seguin building was much more beautiful on Park Avenue when older buildings were around it. And when other glass buildings started popping up around it, it became less special.
Liz, did you have any pause before you designed the new Tully Hall, even the way you did, thinking, more glass?
No, glass is a complicated material. You're showing here reflective glass. There are all sorts of glasses, translucent glass, fritted glass, stained glass. You know, it's quite old. There are tinted glasses. Architects these days, very interesting, are going for really low iron glass, as transparent as you can get. And what's happened in the history of glass, I think, across the 20th century into the 21st, is that initially it was equated with freedom, visual freedom. You got away from the masonry wall. You couldn't do long span structures. You can see, connect the inside with the outside and see forever. But what happened, like in mid-century, was that there was a kind of paranoia because if you can see out, everybody could see in. So then you start to see tinted glass and reflective glass, and you see a lot of reflective glass also for environmental reasons. But today, I think that there is a really interesting phenomenon. It's a kind of post-paranoid phenomenon where people love to be seen. They want to be seen. They want to be on display, and they perform. And so, you know, that therefore this low iron glass, and never mind, you know, sustainability issues. Right. Well, we'll deal with that in another way. But it's very interesting what's happening.
Interesting point to be making while we're inside doing a show inside a glass enclosed studio, too.
Exactly.
I guess
that's right. But we've gone from post wall to post paranoid. And if everybody wants to be seen, then who needs walls anyway? Audience, do you think, and let's again see hands, I'll tell you what. Applaud if you think New York City generally is a more beautiful place than it was 20 years ago. And if you think it's a less beautiful place than it was 20 years ago? What does this tell you, professional? Applauded, too.
I kind of agree. I think that all the development that's going on is pretty, you know, there's very little culture of architecture here in New York. And you know, while there's a lot of control over publicly owned space, and there's a very, City Planning Commission is doing a great job in discussing what's appropriate for New York and not. There's very little of that with private development. And
I think you have to break it down neighborhood by neighborhood, though. I mean, there are neighborhoods that have, in fact, in the last 20 years, restored themselves, recovered, risen and changed and evolved, and in many ways are better.
You have some favorites?
Well, a lot of Brooklyn, although not Williamsburg, which I think basically got ruined by prosperity. It became a victim of prosperity, but a lot of other neighborhoods, I mean, Park Slope, for example, where there hasn't been as much new construction, much more restoration, is much more beautiful than it was, in large part because great older buildings have been cared for wonderfully.
We've got one more slide. We've got about 45 more seconds. All the way to, let's see, okay, this is not the one I thought it was going to be. That's graffiti versus old style. We're trying to go to the very last slide. The skyline. Is this going to be much different in the future? Liz Diller will give you the last word in 20 seconds.
Oh, Jesus. I hope it doesn't get all filled up. That's all I can say. That there is an intelligence to building high. There's an idea about the topography of tall buildings in New York, and I hope that that's respected. And people just don't build high on the water.
Will we be glassier or less glassier in 15 years?
I think we'll be glassier.
Shorter or taller, Paul?
Well, I hope we'll be taller in more limited ways and not an endless city of 50-story boxes.
More public space or less public space?
I hope there'll be a lot more public space.
Sterile or funky?
I hope a little more funky, and I hope a little more connected to the street.
All right. Now, before we say goodbye, we want to mention that the last Cityscapes event is the last one we did, a nature walk at Newtown Creek, done in collaboration with the Architecture League's Urban Omnibus Program, took place last week with us, and it was a smashing success. Almost 100 people showed up, and there will be more details to be decided. You can get all the updates at wnyc.org/cityscapes. And as we wrap up the Cityscapes project, thanks first and foremost to Paul Goldberger for being our Cityscapes guru for the last 5 weeks. And thanks to all four of our architects who visited, Hugh Hardy, Stephen Castle, Michael Van Valkenburg, and Liz Diller. Andrew Blum has been the Cityscapes blogger, writing some really thoughtful pieces at the Cityscapes homepage. They're still up there. Jennifer Ha and the WNYC Interactive team put together the Cityscapes homepage with all the video, photos, and more. And special thanks to the WNYC culture team of Andrea Salenzi, who was also managing our slideshow today in the back, and Benjamin Walker, who helped steer this project from the very beginning. And thanks to all of you listeners for your posts, calls, and fabulous image contributions to the Flickr group. Remember, the Cityscapes project lives on at wnyc.org/cityscapes. An audience here at the Green Space, please thank Paul Goldberger and Liz Diller.